Danny Davis has been suspended for the first two games of the season. Coach Paul Christ announced that suspension 2 days after Wisconsin receiver Quintez Cephas was charged with felony sexual assault. Davis is Cephas' roommate and was identified in a criminal complaint filed by authorities against Cephas and interviewed by police. However, Davis has not been charged with anything. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Thursday, August 23rd. Lovely day today, sunny and pleasant, a high of 79. Tonight, clear and mild, a low of 63. Looks like a rainy one tomorrow. 70% chance of rain on Friday with a high of 70. Right now, humidity 85%, wind from the west at 5. 61 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
I'm tremendously honored to be sitting across the table today from a colleague of mine at Carthage College, Dr. Thomas J. Knorr, Valor Distinguished Professor of Humanities at Carthage College. He has been there a long, long time and is well known to many of you, especially those of you who read the Kenosha News on a regular basis. Surely you have read some of Professor Knorr's marvelous and thought-provoking and often very, very entertaining columns, which appear there regularly on the editorial page. He has done a lot of writing in his long, distinguished career, including two books before the current book, which we are going to be talking about today, a book called Soapy, a biography of G. Menon Williams, published by the University of Michigan Press. That's appropriate because this figure of G. Menon Williams figures so prominently in the history of Michigan. He really helped to utterly reshape life in Michigan and the political landscape there in a really dramatic way. But there is much more to the story of G. Menon Williams than that. He is one of those extraordinary, unique figures who is also all but forgotten, at least as far as the general public is concerned. And this book helps to address that injustice, if you will. And for the next few minutes, I have the pleasure of speaking with the author of this book, again, Dr. Thomas J. Knorr. Professor Knorr, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. And I have really enjoyed exploring this book. Ahead of our conversation, just a word, if I may, about the life of a college professor and the balance that one tries to achieve between teaching and doing this kind of research, which might ultimately lead to the writing of a substantial book like that. Mm-hmm. At a place like Carthage, how does that balance work? Is it a little bit different for everyone? What has that balance been for you?
Well, as you know, Carthage is a teaching institution, and our primary goal is to be effective in the classroom. But I also think that we need to be models to our students and show them that we not only can teach our subject, but we can actually do it. So you do try to strike a balance. It's different than if you were at Madison or a large state university where publishing would be your primary goal. But I've always felt that you need to be an active scholar as well as active in the classroom. It's more difficult for those of us at the Carthages of the world to do this because we don't have graduate students and graduate seminars, and we have heavy teaching loads. We don't have the funding available, but I do think that it's crucial that we not only maintain our classroom presence, but we also go out into the bigger world and try to show that we can actually do whatever it is we're teaching, whether it's music or history or art.
We're speaking with Professor Tom Knorr, and we turn now to this very, very intriguing figure from recent American history, G. Menon Williams, a former governor of the state of Michigan, but much more than that. In fact, a fascinating figure with sort of a three-phase political career, really like none other. You mentioned in the preface that you actually first encountered this person or came to know him at a fairly young age. Tell our listeners that story.
Yeah, my first recollection of Soapy Williams was when I was a young kid in high school. And it was during the 1960 Democratic Convention, and I overruled my father, who wanted to watch a rerun of Maverick, to watch the convention. And that was the night that John Kennedy selected Lyndon Johnson as his running mate, and all of the political pundits predicted there was going to be a floor fight of liberals, and so I was anticipating a bloody verbal brawl. And it turned out that only one person stood up and voted against Lyndon B. Johnson, and that was G. Menon Soapy Williams. I didn't know who he was. This tall, sort of geeky guy in a bow tie who reared his head back and voted no. That got me intrigued, and then I did a book many years later on American foreign policy in Africa, and when Soapy Williams was the Undersecretary of State for Africa, and went through his papers and his materials in National Archives, but I knew nothing much about his earlier career in Michigan, and so I sort of bookended. I saw him as when I was 15 years old, and then in the State Department material for another book called Cold War and Black Liberation. And then got intrigued with Soapy both for his policies and politics, but also for, as you mentioned, his sort of flamboyance and colorful personality. And so I embarked upon trying to do the first really complete biography of Menon Williams.
When did you undertake this, and did anything in particular galvanize it? I mean, were you invited to do this by someone, or?
No, I undertook it because I began to become interested in Williams, and I found that no one had really done his biography. There was a campaign biography in his futile run for president in 1960, but that was a quick job. One of his former campaign managers wrote sort of a memoir, but nobody had really done the life of Menon Williams. And I found that in the Bentley Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, there were the Menon Williams papers, and he saved everything. Thousands and thousands of boxes of paper, hundreds of videotapes, hundreds of audio tapes, and nobody had really gone through this. Mm. So I decided that Soapy was worth a full-scale biography, and wound up spending 2.5 years researching Soapy and about a year writing Soapy. So I've been living with Menon Williams for about 4 years, and still living with him.
I want to ask you a little bit about that experience as a researcher of walking through the doorway of a place like the Bentley Library, and being confronted with what I'm sure was figuratively, certainly, and maybe literally, a mountain of material to go through. For those of us who've never really done that ourselves, how does one do that? How do you go about undertaking a task like that. It just seems so monumental.
It is, but that's what historians are trained to do. Most of our resources are written sources, and the way to do that is to literally go through box by box by box by box. By box, I mean that the papers of people like Men and Williams are in chronological boxes, and you might wind up going through 400 or 500 documents, and only 2 or 3 are really something that you'll wind up using. So it's time-consuming. There is a guide to the Williams papers, but initially I was overwhelmed. I walked into the I got a grant from the Bentley Library, and they welcomed me, and I walked in and looked at it, and they said, "Well, we have 1,500 boxes. Each box contains about 30 containers. Where do you want to start?" And I spent about an hour, and then I wandered in. There is a G. Men and Williams room, and I saw the photos of Soapy with Martin Luther King and with Kennedy and with Walter Reuther. And then I went back and started working my way through it. But it's overwhelming, but you get a sense of being able to go through and decide that this really is a crucial document, or this gives us a nice insight into his life. But much of it is very time consuming.
Was all of this material well organized in the sense that you knew in this box you would find this?
Yeah, the material is organized into two big categories. One is when he was governor, and the rest is called non-governor, which covers his early life and his career in the State Department. And then there's a third group, which is his records when he was on the Supreme Court of Michigan his last 16 years. So there's sort of three big areas. But there's also stacks of photos, over 5,000, which I went through to try to find some for the book. So basically, it is the grunt work of history that you hope yields to an understanding of the person's mind. I mentioned in there that there's one biographer that said, while you're doing all this, you should be singing, "Getting to know you, getting to know all about you." Well, I'm not so sure that's exactly what you do. But you do try to, you hope eventually, to get into the mind and try to figure out not only what he did, but why he did it. And that's the hard part of history. We pretty much know what happened. But the why is what's the intriguing, and that's the hardest thing to do.
Now, as you went into this project, I mean, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, how big an admirer of him were you? I mean, were you an admirer of what he did and what his politics were and how he carried himself through this varied career?
In a sense, changed. I started out, I said, in the middle of his career, looking at his career when he was Undersecretary of State under John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And Williams was probably the most flamboyant and most colorful Undersecretary of State, who nobody knows who Undersecretary of State are. And he was the most outspoken advocate for the end of white control of Africa, decolonization. He was the first to criticize South Africa and call for sanctions. And I greatly admired that. And then I went back and looked at his career as governor and as Supreme Court judge, and admired Soapy for his incredibly strong principles. He was an uncompromising liberal, unabashedly unapologetic, and never changed. And that was both the strength of Soapy and his weakness. He said, "Compromise is not part of my vocabulary." And in the book, and I, in a sense, criticize him at times when compromise might have been helpful for him. He was a strong candidate for the presidency in 1960. Many predicted he would be on the ticket. But he drove the state of Michigan into bankruptcy by refusing to compromise with the legislature. He did exactly what Bill Clinton did. He shut down the government of Michigan. But Clinton, in a sense, succeeded. Soapy, it destroyed his campaign for presidency. He refused to compromise when he was in the State Department. But to Soapy, politics was principles, so I greatly admire him for that. And in the book, I raised the question about should we admire somebody who is unflinching and uncompromising and refuses to modify his beliefs, Or should we suggest that he wasn't practical enough, he wasn't pragmatic enough? And as you mentioned in the opening, his vote against Lyndon Johnson, the only person, was in some ways the epitome of Soapy Williams. He felt that civil rights, when he was the leading advocate in all of America, leading white advocate of racial equality, could not be compromised. It was a moral issue, and that Lyndon Johnson stood for everything he disliked, and he had to publicly vote no. And the irony is, later on, Johnson would become his boss at the State Department. And Johnson always said, oh, well, I forgive you for that, Menon. But he never did. He remembered it. He criticized every member of his party, Adlai Stevenson, Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, for being what he called mushy on civil rights. So it's a long answer that, in a sense, I admire Soapy greatly, but I also recognize his weaknesses. He once said, I'm more a John the Baptist than a disciple. But I point out, John the Baptist lost his head.
It's true.
That's a biblical reference, right, for those
right.
of you.
And of course, the question is one that confronts a lot of historians. I mean, it isn't, you don't necessarily write big, sprawling biographies about someone to whom you feel great admiration. I mean, sometimes you devote a lot of time to somebody who you don't necessarily think very highly of. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like you largely thought and think highly of who he was, or admire many things about him, mm-hmm. even if you don't think he was certainly without flaw.
Yeah, there's much to admire about Soapy. Here's a multimillionaire who became the advocate for what he saw as those less fortunate in America, particularly African Americans, poor workers. Here was a guy who believed that, even though he was himself a Princeton Phi Beta Kappa and a graduate of Michigan Law School, but he was always more comfortable with ethnic groups and calling square dances. He was an incredible flamboyant campaigner, and I talk a lot about the legendary Soapy method. He would shake hands with 5,000 people every morning at 5 o'clock. He would go to 20 or 30 different lunches and ethnic groups. And it's so far from what we do now, where politicians spend hours taping a 30-second commercial and never get out and shake hands. And as I went through Michigan or even Kenosha, I run into people say, oh, I remember Soapy. He came down and spoke to our group, or he shook my hand. And I admire this sort of hands-on, populist, love of the people campaigning of Soapy. And I think that's one of the things that makes him so interesting. Mm.
Something which also makes him stand out in many respects is not this so much, the fact that he was a very religious person, but the way in which his personal religious faith played into how he lived, and especially to how he conducted his politics, and in particular, the sort of unvarnished, unhesitating way in which that was woven right into his rhetoric. I mean, in a way that we really don't see today in quite the same way.
Yeah, that's a major part of the book, and that was something I didn't know about Williams till I got into looking at his early life and his career in Michigan. Soapy was a strong Episcopalian, grew up in the Episcopal Church, went to Episcopal prep school. But his version of religion and politics is the 180 degrees from what it is for most people today. We tend to think of religion now as associated with conservative Christian right. Soapy's religion was the idea that the goal of politics was to do good in the world and to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and help the poor. And he was unabashed with that. His speeches are laced with religious imagery. He would call his enemies fallen sheep and hope for their redemption.
Forgiven sinners.
Exactly. And not everybody thought that God was a liberal Democrat, but Soapy did. And that is very unusual today, where religion is still a very important part of politics, but His version was that this drove him to the ideal of a liberal, activist, reformist politics, and he stuck with it for his whole life.
Hmm. I want to ask you about an important statement that happens towards the beginning of the book. You say that Menin Williams' career showed both the strengths and weaknesses of 20th century American political liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
What are you saying there? What are those strengths and those weaknesses, and how did they play out in his particular story?
Well, as an historian, let me give you some historical background. Michigan, Soapy's home state, was rock-hard conservative Republican before 1948 when he was elected governor. It was dominated by the auto industry. Soapy Williams, in a sense, forged a new coalition of union workers, of African Americans and ethnic groups. And his goal was to bring, quote, a new deal to Michigan. And when he ran for the presidency, his goal was to expand government, more legislation, more government involvement. That is, in a sense, the strength of American liberalism. But as we've seen in the last 30 years, nobody now calls themselves a liberal. Even Ted Kennedy uses the term progressive. Hillary Clinton will not call herself a liberal. It's got a negative connotation to it. And it's partly because I think people like Williams and others' version of liberalism was vulnerable because people began to become disillusioned with that, with the Great Society of Johnson. And social issues, which dominate our politics today, have replaced the old-fashioned economic liberalism of Soapy Williams. So in a sense, he's an anachronism, but a pleasant anachronism. I admire the fact that Soapy was convinced of that. He would be appalled by Ronald Reagan's famous statement that government is not the solution, government is the problem. The Soapy government was the solution. I think the sort of flounderings of the Democratic Party today is that they're not sure anymore what exactly it is government's supposed to do. They certainly have moved a long way from Menin Williams' vision, and I'm not so sure that they have a new one.
Hmm. You've already touched on the fact that one of the most key ingredients in his personality and makeup as a politician was that he had no inclination, especially in these first couple phases of his life and career, to compromise. And you say his convictions were consistent, and that was his problem. I mm-hmm. think that's what you're speaking to right mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, and as I said, in American politics, sometimes you have to be practical. Soapy was not practical. He criticized Adlai Stevenson, the presidential candidate of his party, for being soft on civil rights. When John Kennedy was running in 1960, he gave a blistering, hectoring speech to Kennedy, telling him that he was mushy on civil rights, that he had to see it as a moral issue. And that cost him a cabinet position, I think. And later on, when he was in the State Department, he refused to recognize the fact that there were many who thought Africa wasn't as important as he thought it was. He was, in a sense, consistent, but we tend to look at politics as, quote, winners. Soapy was not a winner in the sense that he never became president, he never became a cabinet member. But to me, he was a winner in the sense that he was consistent with his principles, and he saw politics as a battle between good and evil, and you can't compromise with evil. And to him, segregation and discrimination was a moral evil, and you had to see it as a moral issue. And Kennedy saw it as a political issue. Soapy said, no, it's a moral issue.
Hmm. We're speaking with Professor Tom Knorr, and we're talking about his book called Soapy, a biography of G. Menin Williams, who was governor of Michigan for many years. His victory there in 1948, an astonishing surprise, equal to the surprise of Truman defeating Dewey. And later is an important figure in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, and eventually ascends to the Supreme Court of his home state of Michigan. Your book unlocks some interesting information about G-Men and Williams growing up, and what an interesting, gifted, charismatic figure he was, from a family in which there was wealth on both sides.
Yeah, Men and Williams is what I guess in current terms we call a limousine liberal. There were many millionaires who became liberal advocates, Franklin Roosevelt, Nelson Rockefeller, some degree Kennedy. But Men and Williams grew up, as I said, a child of incredible privilege. His parents, his father, his family had started out selling lunches to workers and eventually opened a pickle factory and invested heavily in real estate in Detroit and became very wealthy. But the real money of Williams came from his mother's side. His mother was the heir to the Menon cosmetic fortune, thus his name, Menon. And that led to the famous nickname of Soapy. He and his two brothers would spend summers at a ranch out in Wyoming, and the cowboys out there would make fun of these rich kids from Grosse Pointe, Michigan. And they called one, and they would refer to the men in company. One of them was called Lather, and one was called Suds, and G. Menon was called Soapy. And his brothers hated the name. He loved it. He used it the rest of his life, even signing government documents, Soapy, rather than G. Menon Williams. And his parents, as I do a lot with his mother, who was quite a character. She was a right-wing, conservative, laissez-faire Republican who hated everything that her son stood for. She could not believe that he would be one hanging around with these union workers and black workers. She was the chairperson of the Republican Party in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and yet her son was this liberal Democrat. She kept an engraved lithograph of Marie Antoinette next to her bed, which was a pretty good indication of her politics. But Soapy, and she paid his dues to the Grosse Pointe Country Club his whole life, hoping he'd come back to his people, meaning millionaire types. Mm. But Soapy, even though he grew up this incredibly wealthy kid, became, as I said, an outspoken advocate of sort of reform and liberalism.
Hmm. He goes to college and to law school and then makes his way to Washington, D.C., actually doesn't easily and quickly find a job, but eventually some kind of position, I think, in the Social Security mm-hmm. Department, right? But fairly quickly returns to Michigan. Mm-hmm. What brings him back to the state of Michigan?
He wants to be governor. His mother was convinced that Soapy should become a member of the diplomatic corps. That was considered appropriate for someone of their class. Diplomatic corps was largely wealthy young men. And when he went off to prep school at Salisbury Academy and then to Princeton, he was working to become a member of the diplomatic corps. But he said later on that he quickly realized as early as his sophomore year in college that he wanted to go into politics, and he wanted to return to Michigan. And so after working in the state or in the Social Security office and being in the Navy in World War II, he comes back to Michigan in 1948, and it's considered hopeless. The Republicans dominated. He was not given a chance. He had no money. His mother would not give him a dime to run for his campaign. And nobody anticipated what's called the Michigan Miracle, where he and his wife, literally on their own, barnstormed the state of Michigan for 4 months, going from town to town in a battered old DeSoto, and won a victory, and then was elected to six terms as governor of Michigan, the only one to serve six terms. So what drove him back to Michigan was he wanted to be a governor, and he wanted to remake the Democratic Party. Also, he wanted to confront the threat of Jimmy Hoffa, which is a major figure in the book and in Michigan politics.
At one point, you you coined the term, not I, that's the wrong way, you utilized the term machine in describing what G-Men and Williams built in Michigan. Like the term liberal for some, maybe even for more people, the term machine has an extremely negative connotation. Mm-hmm. Should we take it that way, or are we talking about a different kind of political machine which he constructed?
Machine we associate with the Chicago corrupt political machine.
Right.
The machine I mean by is incredible political organization. When Williams ran in 1948, the Democratic Party basically had no organization. They didn't even put candidates up in many congressional districts. The legislature at one time was 92-4 Republicans versus Democrats. Soapy and a few other people, Neil Stabler, who was the head of the Democratic Party, in a sense build the party of Michigan. And they make the Democratic Party into this incredibly strong organization that sweeps Williams to six straight terms and became the envy of the country because he mobilized for the first time the power of labor. People like Walter Reuther and other labor leaders had not been involved politically, but Williams gets them involved. And he was accused often of being a tool of labor, even though I point out he and Walter Reuther disagreed on lots of things. But the Michigan Democratic Party became the envy of all the other states because they could get the vote out and they could reelect not just Williams, but many others, even though for lots of times he's the only Democrat that wins. He's all the rest are Republicans, his Secretary of State, his Attorney General. He's the only lone Democrat.
Well, and it's a fascinating scenario. I mean, right off the bat, you talk about how the euphoria of that astonishing election, that first election to the governorship in 1948, the euphoria wore off quickly because then there was this grim Republican reality for him to confront. And as you say time and time again, he confronted it without even the slightest temptation to compromise.
It was a 10-year battle, and the tone was set right away. Williams, when he was elected, the Republicans assumed that this was an aberration. He'd just be in there for 2 years. Soapy had to run every 2 years rather than now every 4 years. He was constantly campaigning. And to send a message to him, they immediately cut the funding for the home for the governor. They used to provide money, and they cut his salary. And they raised the salary of all the other people who were Republicans. So pretty clear it was going to be a battle. And the battle followed almost the form of a minuet. Soapy would propose a huge budget with reform of schools and education, roads and housing. The Republicans would not pass it, and then because they assumed he would be defeated in the next election. The state would borrow the money to pay for his programs, and then 2 years later would go again and again and again. Until finally in 1959, as I said, the state declared bankruptcy. But Soapy was confronted with a legislature that he never had a majority. He always had to deal with a Republican majority in the legislature. And he was convinced that he could override them, and they were convinced that they could defeat him. And so it was, if you like politics in terms of bloody rhetorical battles, you'll love reading about Soapy and the Republican Party and how they battled for 12 years in Michigan.
During this time, of course, he has this incredibly high profile and obviously manages to connect with regular people in some of the ways that you've already been talking about in terms of kind of his charisma and flamboyance and his unique way of doing things to get out there. You mentioned, though, at some point, actually fairly early in the book, you say something about how he was not and never became a great orator. So apparently that was not part of the G-Men and Williams mystique and not a significant part of how he connected with the masses.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Soapy was never a brilliant public speaker. And one Detroit newspaper reporter said it sounded like he was gargling pencils when he spoke. He was very good on a small group. He was never good in a formal speech. And I've listened to his speeches, and to his phone conversations. You have to remember that this is largely pre-television, and he was never comfortable with television. He was very good at the one-on-one, hands-on, but he was not good at giving a formal speech, and he would tell his advisors, just give me a few ideas, and then I will be able to, in a sense, talk about them. But no, he was not an articulate speaker. He was not a great political theorist, but he was the kind of person that liked to get out and be amongst the people and talk with them one-on-one, and that was his appeal. And as I talked later, that when he lost, the only election he lost, when he came back from the State Department to run for the Senate, it showed his weaknesses. Television by then had become dominant, and Soapy was never very good on television. Except for one case where I talk about the Republicans accused him of being this rich kid and having these expensive handmade shoes, which he did, and actually found the receipt for him where he ordered them. And during the TV debates, he took off his shoes and held them up to the camera and said, now that we've taken care of the Republicans' issues, we can talk about the real problems of Michigan. That was one case where he used it. But no. He was not a terribly articulate speaker, but he was a sincere speaker. People commented on that.
To encapsulate this tough road he had to, in Michigan, confronting these Republicans at every turn, I think a really interesting story comes from towards the end of that tenure as governor, with the opening and the dedication of this Mackinac Bridge, which was a kind of a dream project of his, and the day that it was dedicated, the way that all unfolded is kind of an interesting story in some ways, kind of an indication of what much of this governorship was like.
Yeah, the Mackinac Bridge, which those of you not from Michigan don't know, Mackinac Bridge connected the Upper Peninsula and the main part of Michigan, and he had been calling for it since 1948, and it was seen as Soapy's folly. This will never be built, it's too expensive. Many Republicans didn't want to build it because the Upper Peninsula was heavily Democratic. And he battled for years, and finally it opened, and he was ecstatic, and that he was going to be the one, the first to drive a car across the bridge. And then he would unveil a plaque which would dedicate the bridge. And at this high point of his life, when he thought he'd finally succeeded, one of the Republican speakers pulled the curtain and unveiled the plaque before he could, and he was terribly angry with that. But the Mackinac Bridge was one of his permanent achievements, and later on, as an old man, when he was sitting down trying to sketch out his memoirs, he never finished them, he said, well, maybe I should have done more things like that. The Mackinac Bridge, a permanent achievement, rather than battling over the budget or battling over civil rights. But he loved Mackinac Island. That's where he's buried. And the bridge is, to many, the sort of achievement of Williams. Not many people know that he built it, but it is sort of the thing that many people identify with Soapy. When he died, the Detroit News published a cartoon showing Soapy's bow tie, his symbol, connecting the two Michigans as a reference to the Mackinac Bridge.
Interesting. Well, he proceeds from the rough-and-tumble world of Michigan politics to Washington, D.C., which can be its own rough-and-tumble town. But you say that he really adapted to that new life and that new, for him, political landscape actually remarkably well, and did some very important things in terms of, I think you term it, a real sort of reshaping of American foreign policy in regards to Africa.
Yeah, I give Soapy very high marks for that. He was bitterly disappointed. He thought for sure that he would be appointed Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, or Secretary of Labor, because he had campaigned for Kennedy, he had endorsed Kennedy. But Kennedy saw him as too liberal and instead appointed him Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, seemingly an obscure minor position. And he was very bitter. He had to be talked into taking the job. But then he was convinced that he could use this job to not only make Africa now important, but to keep himself in the public's eye. And he was, as I said, incredibly successful in terms of both personal diplomacy. He made 13 trips to Africa in 4 years. And he said he had to show Africans that America considered them important. And again, for those young, Africa was going through the surge to independence. And he also was very effective in arranging for Kennedy and later Johnson to meet with African leaders. So symbolically, he wanted to show them that Africa was important to us. And he got in trouble for that. His famous speech where he said Africa is for the Africans provoked a flurry because whites in Africa felt he was saying, well, they had no place in Africa. He was actually punched in the nose by a white Rhodesian after saying that. But he also was effective in policy levels. He was convinced that the white governments of South Africa and Angola and Rhodesia were doomed, and America should get on the side of the black majority. He pushed Kennedy strongly to take a stance against apartheid. And Kennedy finally did institute an arms embargo, the first really step we took to try to pressure South Africa to change. He was never effective in getting sanctions, which later on we would impose 20 years later. But he was the spokesperson for making Africa important and for the idea that America needs to support the idea of Africa as a black continent, and these white regimes are running out of time. And I give him credit for that. Didn't make him popular. Many in the State Department, the Defense Department, many Southerners hated Soapy for doing that. But again, he was uncompromising. This to him, again, was a moral issue. Majority rule meant a black majority, and we should get on the side of what he saw as right.
When G-Man and Williams returns to Michigan, he is anxious for one of two positions. I guess this would be after his the unsuccessful election bid. He hopes either to be appointed to the Michigan Supreme Court, or he hopes to be selected as president of, I think it's Michigan State University. And this is a particularly fascinating part in the book, I think, in which he plunges into what is a really unabashed campaign for both of those positions, and especially in terms of campaigning for the presidency of Michigan State University. He seems utterly clueless that one just doesn't do that, and doesn't seem to realize he's sabotaging his effort just by the way in which he goes about it.
Yeah, it's an intriguing story. After his defeat for the Senate, he was appointed briefly as ambassador to the Philippines by Lyndon Johnson for about a year. And is famous there, again, for the Soapy Williams PR campaign. I have a photo in there of him in stripped down to his swimming suit riding a water buffalo, which caught the press. But then he came back to Michigan, and he wanted again to run for political office, but he needed something to keep his name in the limelight. So he pursued, as you said, simultaneously two campaigns, one to become president of Michigan State, one to become Supreme Court judge. And he didn't know that you're not supposed to run for president of a college. And he goes through a whirlwind campaign. He signs up labor leaders and politicians endorsing him. He gets faculty to sign an open letter supporting him, and it backfires. The faculty at Michigan State send a letter back to him saying, this is not the way you become a president. You're not supposed to be campaign for it. And his advisors say, you have to tone this down. You can't. You have to kind of be a reluctant sort of candidate. Well, that was not Soapy's way. And the result is he didn't get the presidency of Michigan State. They fought for over a year. And so instead he becomes elected to the Supreme Court, still convinced that that will only be temporary, that then he'll go back and run for governor or he'll run for Senate again. But he winds up spending the last 16 years of his life on the Supreme Court. He toys with the idea of running again, but his advisors say, in a sense, you're too old, you're too out of touch. Times have changed. This is the 1980s by now. And so he becomes fairly content, even though he still broods about the fact that he wishes he could still be governor again. He loved being governor. He loved the attention. The Supreme Court was a different thing.
Although he made some things happen there and eventually is Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court.
Yeah. Again, the section on the Michigan Supreme Court years was the hardest for me to write because they didn't want to write just a long list of legal decisions and so court cases. But he's most famous for, in a sense, modernizing and computerizing the Michigan court system. That doesn't sound like a very flashy issue to us now, but you have to remember that computers were still relatively new. He knew nothing about computers. But he was convinced that to make the courts more efficient, you needed to use this new technology. And he actually goes to conferences, and he writes to people and gets papers, and he gives lectures, and he writes down on notepads what is, these different computer terms. What does it mean to interface? But also he writes some incredibly important decisions, particularly ones dealing with environmental law and pollution laws, which became landmark decisions. But computerizing and modernizing the courts of Michigan was his legacy as much as his legal opinions.
You mentioned before we went on the air that one of the libraries where you did research, a young worker there kind of inadvertently opened up to you certain legal records and so on, which technically were sealed, and but for a couple of days you enjoyed some unencumbered access to
them. The Supreme Court, which are 108 boxes of, are technically closed forever because judges would write confidential memos to each other, and but I put in a request for them, and this poor young little graduate student brought them to me, and I didn't say anything. And for 2 days, I got to go through nearly half of his Supreme Court records until the director of the archive said, "Oh, no, these are closed forever," and took them away from me. So I did get to read not only the decisions, but some of the conferences and memos that other judges had written, sometimes very personal comments about other judges. That's why they're closed, saying, "I think so-and-so doesn't know what he's talking about," or... I was fortunate in that case. There are summaries of the decisions, and some of his clerks wrote about him, but I did get to through that. And the chapter in the Supreme Court years also includes some other stuff. For example, the fact that he was mugged in the parking lot of Detroit, and the fact that he was beginning to try to assess his place in history, and how did he want to be remembered. I mean, he was 76 when he left the court, so he knew he wanted to get down the record. He never wrote about autobiography, but he started sketching out some notes on it.
But yes, he, rather surprisingly for a man so physically fit and active, dies quite suddenly of a cerebral hemorrhage, 76 years old. You choose to devote some time in the book to some of what was written about him in the wake of his unexpected death, and especially things that were written by ordinary citizens. Where did you find those, and what do you think that tells us about G. Menin Williams?
Yeah, Williams was, as you mentioned, a physical fitness fanatic. As a young kid, he lifted weights, he boxed, he ran. He was a Olympic-quality rower, tried out for the Olympic team when he was at Princeton, was an alternate. But died a very sudden death less than a year after he left the Supreme Court. And I write in the chapter about the funeral that all of the dignitaries, 500 different nation or different people came from every nation almost in the world, judges from all over, politicians, leaders. But then I found a box called Letters, Ordinary People. And they were letters that people had written on cheap three-penny postcards and scratch paper, all talking about Soapy. And I remember when he came to our town, they were written to his wife. And one of the most moving is from a black woman in Detroit that said, "I used to walk past your church, St. Paul's Cathedral, and I really wanted to go in, but I was afraid to go in. But you made it okay for me to do that. You made it okay for all black people to be free in Michigan." And those are the sort of things I think Soapy would have been more happy than all the accolades he got from presidents and governors and Supreme Court people. The funeral was a massive thing. They had to actually hundreds of people lined up outside. They couldn't get into the St. Paul's Cathedral. But I think Soapy would have been more happy with the letters from these ordinary folk that say, I remember when you came around and gave me a cardboard bow tie, which was a symbol. I remember when you shook my hand. And one of the eulogists, Governor James Blanchard, said Soapy shook hands with everybody in Michigan at least twice. And I think he would like to be remembered for that.